Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. This morning in the first hour of the show, we'll be talking with Homer Hickam. I think a lot of people will know him for his autobiographical novel, Rocket Boys. This tells the story of his growing up in Colwood, West Virginia, and it was the basis for a film, October Sky. After that, he went to Virginia Tech, studied engineering, served in the military, and after that, went to work for NASA, where he worked in the area of spacecraft design and crew training. He's also a writer and has been writing for a long time. His first book was Military History. That was Torpedo Junction. His second was the memoir Rocket Boys. His first fiction novel was Back to the Moon. That was published in 1999. He has now just published a new novel. This is a novel for adult readers, young adult readers, I should say. And the title of the book is Crater. It has just come out. It's the first in a projected trilogy. It's published by Thomas Nelson, and it is set on the moon in the 22nd century, revolves around the life of miners living on the moon. A lot of people have given it high marks, both as a coming-of-age story and also for its vision of what life in a permanent moon settlement might be like. He's spending some time now talking about the book, and we're pleased that he could spend some time with us to talk about it and about his writing generally. Questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to call in, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That one's for you if you would be using that, making a long-distance call. You could use that. The call's on us, 800-222-9455. We also have an email, will-talk@illinois.edu, if you'd like to send in your question that way. But any way you want to do it, by mail, by calling, we'd certainly welcome you into the conversation. And Mr. Hickam, hello.
Well, hello, David. Good morning.
Well, thanks very much for giving us some of your time today. We certainly appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure.
You know, I think that until now, until Crater, the only book that you had written that was set in space was Back to the Moon. And I guess that some people might be surprised, you know, given your background, given the fact that you had worked for NASA and were certainly are interested in space, maybe some people would be surprised that you hadn't written more science fiction.
Well, of course, John Steinbeck was a marine biologist, and I think he only wrote one book that had anything to do with marine biology. So we writers like to write about a lot of different things. I had a passion for space flight when I was in high school, and I wrote about that in Rocket Boys. And ultimately, when I was 38 years old, I finally did get to go to work for NASA, and I really, really enjoyed it. But it wasn't my only interest in life, and really my passion has always been writing. And I've been fortunate to be able to do that as well as do some of the other things that I've been passionate about.
Yeah. Well, that's I read with some interest that your interest in writing goes back a long way. I think there were a couple of interviews where you said that actually when you were in the third grade, your teachers thought, oh, this kid's going to grow up to be a writer.
Yeah, and when she told me that, I'd written a short story that she really, really liked, and she had mimeographed it and passed it all around the school, and she said, someday, Sonny, you'd make your living as a writer. And I thought to myself, well, why wait? You know, I could use the money now. So so I actually started a little newspaper there in Colwood, this little mining town, and it was quite a success. It was more like the Colwood Inquirer. I would write stories about why Mr. Brown was seen chewing tobacco on the post office steps while Mrs. Brown was up in the garden hoeing the peas and working on the tomatoes, and wondering why Mr. Brown got time off while Mrs. Brown had to do all the work. This kind of thing. People in Colwood loved that. I also wrote about the new preacher's wife, and I followed her around in the company store and wrote down everything that she bought. So, that's when I learned that what people are really interested in is other people. However, the best story that I wrote in my little newspaper was about this lady who chased a snake in the creek and then fell down. And I wrote it like it was really, really funny, and people got a kick out of it. The only trouble was it was my mom that I wrote about, and she took away my First Amendment rights there in Colwood the rest of the time I lived there.
prior restraint. That's a very troubling thing. But when it comes from your parents, what are you going to do? Yeah, exactly. Let's talk about Crater, which is actually the name of a character. You'd expect, well, you'd find craters on the moon for sure, but your protagonist, his name is Crater. Tell us about him.
Well, Crater is a 16-year-old boy. He's an orphan. His first parents were killed getting to the moon, and then his adoptive parents were killed on what we call the scrapes of the Helium-3 mine out in Moontown, where Crater was raised. And eventually, Crater starts to work on the Helium-3 scrapes himself. There's no child labor laws in the moon on the 22nd century. The way I perceive it is that it will be a series of company towns spotted all over the moon where they mine helium-3, and as soon as you're able, you go to work there. It's very much like the early 20th century in the coal fields of West Virginia, where there were no child labor laws and everybody worked. So I do see that as the future. Crater, of course, it's more the story branches out where Crater is sent on a mission by the mine owner across 1,000 miles of the moon, being a scout on a Helium-3 convoy and getting into all kinds of adventures and such. So it it does have a wide range. Ultimately, Crater ends up into space. But I get to invent what I think may be the future, and I try to base it on it's not fantasy by any means. Everything is based on possibilities, and hopefully I've written a pretty good adventure for young adults, and a lot of adults seem to like it too.
Well, it is technically considered to be young adult fiction, which I believe is roughly supposed to appeal to people between 12 and 18, but certainly there are a lot of adults who read these books, and I'm sure a lot of people will read it and enjoy it, and a lot of those people, I'm sure, will be older than 18 years old.
Yeah, some people have called it Huckleberry Finn on the moon, and of course, I consider that high praise. And in this case, I've had a lot of parents and grandparents buy Crater for their teenage boy, who they may be having trouble getting to read, because after all, Crater is a teenage boy, and unlike some of the more recent young adult novels, it is written with the boy as the protagonist, and so that's a little bit unusual these days, because the publishers know that in fact it's teenage girls who do most of the reading, and unfortunately we've lost the teenage boy reader to a great extent. So Crater is to a certain extent my attempt to engage the teenage male and giving him a good read that hopefully will spark his interest in reading other things. And there is a little romance in there, so the teenage girls will like it as well. I mean, the only problem is, of course, Maria is the young lady in the novel. She's always interested in Crater kissing her, but he keeps pointing out that they're both wearing space helmets, so that makes it difficult.
So you did definitely set out with the idea that maybe you had had something of an ideal reader in mind, and that you were wanting to write something specifically for adolescent or young adolescent boys.
Yeah, there's a huge deficit in the boys' adventure books these days, and because I was raised on them, I loved them, not only science fiction, but the Hardy Boys and this kind of book that really engaged me as a reader and wanted me to read more. And I read everything when I grew up, though. I loved to read. My parents, my dad was the superintendent of the coal mine, and he was a avid reader, and he was a member of several Book of the Month clubs. And when he and my mom would put a book down, I'd pick it up. It didn't matter what it was, whether it was an adult book or whatever. I would read it primarily because I was interested in what my dad knew. I wanted to know as much as he did, if that was possible, and I wanted to know what he was thinking. So I was primed on all kinds of books, but I did dearly love the boys' adventure tales.
And this book, I think, has been characterized as something of a throwback, and I don't mean that in a negative sense, but maybe like some of the kind of science fiction that people were writing in the 50s. And in fact, some people have compared you to Robert Heinlein, which I think is not so bad. Were there some particular authors in that genre that you read or that were important to you?
Yeah, well, of course, Heinlein, absolutely. That is high praise to be compared to him. And his writing was spare, and I suppose mine is too. And so I'm careful not to read too much Heinlein these days, and also Steinbeck. Both of them had styles that were similar to mine, and perhaps I've just absorbed them over the years. But if I read them too closely to when I start writing, I end up writing a lot of bad Steinbeck and bad Heinlein. You have to kind of get those voices out of your head and make the style your own.
Yeah, our guest in this hour of Focus is Homer Hickam. He is a writer, is author of a number of books. As I mentioned at the beginning, maybe a lot of people will know him for his autobiographical novel, Rocket Boys, but he's written a number of other books and has a brand new one, which is for young adult readers. It is intended to be the first in a trilogy. The title of the book is Crater. It's set on the moon, 120 years in the future, and it's published by Thomas Nelson. And questions, comments are welcome. Certainly, if you'd like to talk with Homer Hickam, you can do that, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And there's always email. If you want to do that, too, you can send us an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. Within the field of speculative fiction, there's a big range, and there are authors that, on the one hand, give complete freedom to their imagination. They just go and whatever they want to do, they can do. And then there are other writers who feel they really need to stick to what is plausible given what we know about science. And you're more in that category. Is there some impulse again that, you know, makes you want to try to stick to the facts, have something that would be as realistic as possible given the fact that you're imagining something that does not yet exist?
Yeah, I'm just not a fantasy writer. I'm not a big fan of the fantasy genre. Of course, I love Lord of the Rings, the original, the Tolkien's series, but I think that everything else in the fantasy arena or genre has just been a pale copy of what Tolkien did. So I'm trying to, in a way, blaze a new trail while also staying a bit in the groove of the old masters, the old sci-fi masters, with Crater. Of course, I'm also an engineer, and I have an idea of what might be plausible. And to me, that's interesting to take true physics and true engineering and try to figure out how people would really live on the moon 120 years in the future. However, I have to say that I do have a horse in this book, a horse on the moon, and I have received some grief from some young readers about a horse. They just can't imagine that a horse could live on the moon. And I said, well, let me get this straight. Your favorite novels these days is about this boy in England who waves a wooden stick and says magic words and wonderful, bizarre things happen. And also you love this series about this young girl who can't figure out whether she wants to marry a vampire or a werewolf, and you're giving me trouble about having a horse
on the moon? All right. Well, we have some callers here. Why don't we talk with them and start in with first person in line here. This is someone in Champaign, and it's line number one. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Hi. I was. I hope you excuse my mental image. Being from the movie October Sky, but I think that's a nice image, and I really enjoyed that story. So I'm glad to hear you on the local radio here.
Well, thank you. I apologize for not actually being Jake Gyllenhaal. I usually have to apologize to the young ladies when I go out making speeches for not being Jake, but I do remind them that I am in touch with him. I do have a cell phone number, and I can't be bought.
Right. Well, I was kind of curious about what kind of parallels you see between maybe your youth growing up in Appalachia with a coal mining background and parallels with the future on the moon. And I could take that question off of you. Thank you very much.
Oh, well, thank you. It's a good question. I see it absolutely parallel, and that's the way I wrote it. It has been called Coalwood on the Moon. And I agree with that. I certainly extrapolate from my experience growing up in that rough little town in West Virginia. And however, it was less rough when I grew up there in the 1950s than it was at the turn of the century, when it was essentially in a lawless area. The only law was whatever the mine operator said it was, and that was a whole different way of life. And I perceive that when we go out to the moon, we'll leave most of governments behind, and it'll be private entrepreneurs up there trying to make a living. And the people that will be come to those towns will be the same as the ones that came to Coalwood in the early 20th century, and that was people desperate for a job or trying to escape the societies that they came from, in some cases criminals, trying to get away from their past. A lot of different, very rough people came into that area, and ultimately they put down roots and had families and created quite a nice little civilization there. And I do believe that if the moon is ever settled, it will be with that kind of people.
I appreciate the caller's question. We'll go on to somebody on a cell phone here. This is line number two. Hello.
Hi. Am I on?
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, great. Thank you so much. I'm just here from Oregon visiting, but I think I'm going to Champagne's Farmer's Market Saturday. Where can I buy his book?
I imagine in any bookstore you can buy his book.
Well, it better be in any bookstore. If it's not, I've got to talk to my publisher.
Well, and I'm also apologizing for not knowing the author. I'm 70 years old, but I sat on Buster Crabbe's lap. There's a picture of me as a little kid in New York telling him what I wanted for Christmas. And then Flash Gordon sold out and became Tarzan.
Well, that's right. Of course, I was raised on all of that, too. We actually had television in Coalwood. A lot of people can't believe that. But back in the 1950s, we did.
I'm pretty sure that my grandmother in Queens, New York, had the first television in the apartment. It was named Fada, F-A-D-A, which I named my dog after.
Well, Buck Rogers, Flash Gordon, Captain Video, and all of those. Rod Brown and the Rocket Rangers, all those wonderful early sci-fi characters well before Star Trek ever was thought of.
Oh, yeah. And it's really, I can't wait to get your stuff. And I have lots of time to read out. I'm staying on a farm here. So great. I love the show. So
thank you. You can go out, by the way, you can go out also on the Internet and get all of my books. HomerHickam.com. It's spelled H-I-C-K-A-M, HomerHickam.com.
Oh, okay. And I don't have any of that stuff, but the art gallery I'm connected with has all that. So I'll get on top of it. And, well, I love this show. This is, I don't miss it. I lived out here years ago, so it's my favorite show. And although your farmer's market is great, the one in Eugene and Portland, Oregon is pretty fantastic, too. So I'm missing that and my grandkids. Anyway, thank you so much. This is a wonderful show. Bye.
Well, okay. Thanks for the call. For the benefit of everybody else listening, maybe I'll introduce again our guest, Homer Hickam. Indeed, his name is spelled H-I-C-K-A-M. And as I mentioned in the beginning, I think a lot of people will know him for the book that he wrote about his growing up in West Virginia. That was Rocket Boys. It was indeed adapted and made into a movie titled October Sky. And he has written a number of books. He's written some military history. He's written fiction. And as I mentioned, his new book is a book for young adult readers, but I'm sure many grown-ups will read it and enjoy it. The title of the book is Crater. It's the first of a projected trilogy. It takes place on the moon in the future. Thomas Nelson is the publisher. He's spending some time talking about his writing, and we're pleased to have him here on the show. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We talked a little bit about your having grown up in this mining town. Your dad was a mine engineer, and he pretty much expected that you would be one too, or that you would go into the mining field. And he thought that your interest in rocketry was just a big waste of time. Given that you had that kind of background, that I'm sure a lot of people just did what their dads and granddads had done, what was it that made you think about doing something different?
Well, I had my mom, who absolutely was dedicated to seeing both of her sons go to college. And that was the mantra, by the way, of most of the town. Most of the town, my dad couldn't see this, but most of the town perceived that theirs were the last generation that were going to have a steady job in a coal mine. And they determined to educate their children and send them out into the wider world well-equipped to do anything that they wanted to do. So, oddly enough, down in southern West Virginia, one of the poorest counties in the country, we had an excellent educational system. And 80% of the kids in my class in the Colwood School went to and graduated from college. And if they don't all die out, we're working on the other 20% still. We'd like to see them all go. So Colwood was a study in contradictions. By the way, the book Rocket Boys is the most picked book for community and library reads across the country, well ahead of second place To Kill a Mockingbird. It's been translated into, I don't know, about 20 languages now. We even got the French have finally decided to translate Rocket Boys. So it is a bit of a phenomena. It is a classic. It is one that I know that I'll always be remembered by, and I'm very proud of it. It's also being developed into a Broadway musical right now. So it's a story that kind of transcends its author, if you will. Mm-hmm. It's a story that American people and really the people of the world have grasped and understand. It has a lot of threads to it. The father-son relationship is a very important one. But a lot of people take a great deal of inspiration about these kids in this coal town who set their eyes on the stars, and ultimately at least one of them made it, and that was me.
Yeah. The character in the book, Crater, the book is named Crater, and that's the name of the protagonist, the main character in the book, Crater. I would think if you were a parent, you know, that he has a lot of the qualities that you'd actually like to see in your children. He's a pretty straight arrow kind of guy, unlike a lot of the dark and complex characters that you see today in science fiction. At the same time, and this perhaps goes back to the idea that the style here, the feeling is like the science fiction writing of an earlier age. I suppose some people have said he's a little too good. He's a little too pure. He's a little too straight arrow.
Well, it's a challenge always to take a character like that and make him interesting. Crater doesn't know how to lie, and to me that's very interesting. That is lying and cheating and stealing and other nefarious activities these days are quite often celebrated in a variety of different types of books. And so I wanted to create a character that was most unlike other characters, and this was one who didn't know how to lie. And that means that he was going to be taken advantage of. It was my modus operandi, if you will, to get Crater off on his adventure, because the company owner is looking for someone who is naive and he's looking for a man at first who is naive and can be easily manipulated and lied to and sent off to pick up a package that's already killed two other men. And so he lights upon Crater, this innocent youth who just wants to work on the helium-3 scrapes and do the best job he possibly can. And but now Crater does have one advantage, and that is on his shoulder sits a clump of slime mold cells. It's a biocomputer called the Gilly, which, by the way, is illegal, but the Gilly knows that. And the Gilly has no scruples whatsoever. And the Gilly was the only thing that his natural parents left him. And so Crater doesn't much like the Gilly, but because he can't afford any other way of communicating, the Gilly's also a communicator, he allows the Gilly to ride on his shoulder or in a holster on his arm. So there's a lot of back and forth between Crater and the Gilly as Crater becomes more worldly or moonly, as the case may be, and the Gilly kind of guides him.
Yeah, so that's maybe one, we talked about this being, I think you would call it hard science fiction writing, because it tries to be grounded in realism. But this is one element that's a little bit that stretches things just a little bit.
Well, you know, I believe that is the next big revolution in technology is going to be biology. I believe that we will live to see, I may not live, but you may, to see the day when computers are actually biological in nature. And slime mold actually is a fascinating substance that that apparently, even though it's a unicell, that they gather together and figure things out. They're able to figure out mazes. They're able to figure out where their food is. They're able actually to grow temporary legs and almost appear to walk around. So they're fascinating. So I decided to make the first or the ghillie into out of slime mold. But we're going to have a lot of very interesting moral implications when we start making computers out of biological substances, and that is, what do you do with an old one? After all, they are going to be somewhat sentient. And do you just, you throw an old computer away? What do you do with essentially a sentient being that has been your helpmate, but now maybe is a little bit out of date?
Well, I do. I think you can see as a writer the usefulness of the sidekick. Whether it's unconventional, whether it has an unconventional form, particularly if your lead character is a little naive, it always helps to have some voice that is there reminding them just how little they actually know.
Yeah, and Crater also is a nonviolent fellow, although he's been taught by a couple of nefarious fellows in the Dust Palace where he was raised. That's the bachelor officer quarters, if you will. There in Moontown, one's called Doom and the other one's called Head Splitter. And these two fellows have taught Crater the martial arts, but Crater is the totally nonviolent in nature. But the ghillie's not, and when it comes time for Crater to actually fire a rifle on the moon, this is a railgun type of rifle, Crater just can't do it, but the ghillie can. And so, again, this is somewhat of a, if you will, a reverse morality play, in that Crater learns as he goes along that he has to do things that are not what he considers right, just in order to survive. And we watch Crater kind of grow in that direction, and thus that's why it's a trilogy. We're going to see where we go with this totally innocent boy, Crater, as he gets out into the wide moon and space, and people are trying to kill him or do bad things to him. How does he react to that? Does he turn the other cheek, or does he, in fact, become more like them?
Yeah. Our guest in this hour of Focus is Homer Hickam. We'll talk some more after a very short break. This is Focus.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, breathing life into the history of our nation's musical past through exhibits, guided tours, and performances at the University of Illinois. More information is available and visits can be scheduled at 217-244-9309.
This is Focus. It's our morning talk show. We're here Monday through Friday, 10 to noon, and we have 10 different topics as we move through the week. In the second hour today, our guest is economist Enrico Moretti. He teaches at University of California, Berkeley. We'll talk about his new book. It's The New Geography of Jobs, that makes this argument that when you're successful, or if you're going to be successful, it's not just going to be about who you are and your background and your training, but it will also have a lot to do with where you live. Tomorrow morning, we'll have a couple of archives in the first hour. This is a conversation that I had in January with James Ledbetter. He's a journalist who's written a book about Dwight Eisenhower and his concerns about the military-industrial complex. The title of the book is Unwarranted Influence, and we were talking roughly speaking, about the 50-year anniversary of his having given that speech, where he warned about the military-industrial complex. Then hour two tomorrow, Tina Rosenberg, she's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, talks about her book, Join the Club, How Peer Pressure Can Transform the World. You can check the schedule by going to the website, our website, will.illinois.edu. You can also follow us on Twitter, @WillPublicMedia. In this hour of Focus, we're talking with Homer Hickam. He's a writer, has written different kinds of things. He's author of a memoir that's about his growing up in Colwood, West Virginia. That book was Rocket Boys. He's also written military history. He's written fiction. His brand new book is the first of this trilogy he's talked about. A Crater is the title of the book. It's a book for young adult readers. Thomas Nelson is the publisher. And having said, though, it's for young adults, I'm sure that a lot of people, people of different ages, will enjoy reading the book, so you can take a look at it. And questions are welcome if you'd like to call in and talk with our guest, Homer Hickam, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, Mr. Hickam, just, you know, recently there has been some news about a privately funded space effort getting into space, and the possibility that they have launched something that's intended for the space station. And there has, I think, in the past few years, been a lot of conversation about the role that the private sector might play in space exploration. And I'm interested in having you talk a little bit about that. Again, given the fact that sort of your vision for what these moon bases might look like is that essentially they're company towns that would have been privately funded. So do you, and I wonder how, just what you think about that, this balance of the space project being on the one hand something that nations do, or on the other hand being something that private corporations do.
Yeah, I think that's the coming thing, David. The American federal government has made it pretty clear, I think, since the Apollo program, really, that their interest or its interest in human spaceflight is rather low. They don't see that human spaceflight is necessary for national security. They don't see that human spaceflight is even much needed for national prestige, and so it has been diminished since Apollo. Over all the administrations, it's Republican and Democrat alike, they've essentially starved NASA. NASA is a very tiny little agency. Most people think it's really big. It's quite small. It gets barely one half of 1% of the federal budget. The Department of Justice, for instance, gets four times more money than NASA does. So it's basically just barely managed to, in terms of human spaceflight, eke out its existence. It was allowed by one vote, I think it was, in Congress to build the International Space Station, just a few votes to even build the space shuttle, which turned out to be a very, very flawed vehicle, primarily because of the budget and the schedule and the Department of Defense putting some criteria on it to loft spy satellites, which it never did. The shuttle was a flawed machine, and NASA over the years has tried to come up with a variety of new space vehicles, and every time when they've gotten close, it's been canceled for one reason or the other. So NASA is essentially pretty dispirited right now. It lacks very good management, and so what we see is astonishingly, well, my mom used to say that God looks after fools, drunks, the United States of America, and her little sunny boy. I think in this case, God has looked after the United States in the person of Elon Musk, who is an acquaintance of mine. Elon is born in South Africa, come to this country early on, became a citizen, and through his own using his own money from PayPal, which he invented and then sold. He has managed to create a most remarkable little company called SpaceX, with mostly staffed by Gen Xers, Gen Yers, and they have managed to do what NASA has not been able to do for a very long time, and that's to build a whole fleet of new rocket launchers and even a cargo carrier called the Dragon, which is in space today and is maneuvering around the International Space Station, and may ultimately be able to carry our astronauts back into space.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure that there are some people who would say that going to the moon and establishing a permanent, or if not permanent, a long-term human presence there is certainly a big engineering challenge. But maybe the bigger challenge is to figure out how you're going to pay for it, because it's going to be very expensive. So that gets to this question, well, what there's got to be a why for going there. Your answer to that question is why go there is the moon has exploitable resources. And the one thing that you write about here, helium-3, is a real thing that exists on the moon and not much on the Earth, and has applications for energy generation So you think that in fact, that there will be, that private business will find enough of a payback, enough of a reason to go, so that they would be willing to spend the tremendous amount of money that it would actually take to do it?
Well, you know, there are two tracks that we could end up going down, and we may end up, who knows, going down both of them. One of them is the analog of the South Pole Station. Since the mid-1950s, the United States has maintained a very expensive base right on the bottom of the world, in the South Pole. Most Americans don't even know that, but the National Science Foundation runs it. It Department of Defense funds part of it, and there's a great deal of money that's been spent to put a station down in the South Pole, and it's only there for one reason. It's entirely for scientific purposes. And the American government feels that there is a necessity to have this station down there. A future administration may feel that it will be a necessity to have a similar station on the moon, and so that track could yet occur. However, I come from a hard-headed people there in southern West Virginia who believe that you need to make money when you do these things. That's why they were down there. That's why they were digging out the coal. Ultimately, was to make money so that would pay salaries and they could raise their families. And so I think a business case will have to be made to go to the moon and actually live there. Helium-3 is a potential very, very powerful business case. Helium-3 is a product of the solar wind. It has been deposited on the moon for billions of years. It doesn't reach us because of our magnetic field and our atmosphere. Helium-3, it turns out, according to fusion researchers, and fusion is a potential amazing energy source for us. It'll be clean, totally clean energy using the same physics as the sun. Helium-3, it turns out, is one of the best possible fuels for fusion reactors. So a business case may be made when we start building fusion reactors, if we ever do, and I believe that we will, a business case can be made to go to the moon, recover helium-3, and bring it back to this planet. Now, I think there are a lot of other resources that then would start to be acquired. There's a lot of titanium on the moon, calcium, aluminum. There's all kinds of metals on the moon, rare earths. There's also just the moon itself. I've often said that a piece of the moon is truly priceless in a lot of different ways. That if you ever messed up with your wife and you could go down to the jewelry store and buy her a necklace with a moon rock attached to it, that would be priceless. And I'd say, honey, I just brought you a piece of the moon. And so the business cases can be made for this. It may, before we send people out there, we may be sending robots to the moon to pick up just pieces of the moon and bring it back for commercial purposes. I would love to see that.
About 10 minutes left in this part of Focus with writer Homer Hickam. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You can also send an email if you want. That's will-talk@illinois.edu. Here's another caller here in Champaign County where we are, line one. Hello.
Hi, good morning. I was in the same, class of people devouring the Heinlein and the science fiction in my youth, but I wanted to, since you wrote military history as well, a couple of weeks ago, maybe recent than that, there was discussion of the space shuttle in the context of engineering and design and failures, and I'd brought up the point about how the Feynman moment with the rubber O-rings was sort of novelistic in the sense that it could be tied to the whole pressure to launch from the non-engineering people and the idea that it, and this guy admitted it and confirmed it, that there was pressure because the State of the Union speech by Reagan was going to include a teacher in space, and that was the first disaster. But
I have the book for you. It is a book called Paco, the Cat Who Meowed in Space. It's a Kindle single. It's an e-book only. You get it out on Amazon. You download it to your iPod or iPad or your Kindle. And it is about my early years working for NASA. It came out the same time Crater did, and has done fantastic. It includes, I was on the Challenger committee, or not the committee, but the Challenger engineering group that we discovered what really happened with the Challenger. So if you'll go out, and it also includes the story of my cat, Paco, who saved a space mission by meowing in space, but that's a never mind. If you really want to know what happened on Challenger, and people who have read Paco say that this really opened their eyes, and it's different from what you think, go out and read Paco, the cat who meowed in space.
Well, the guy didn't take my point about a further point, which is about the military history of the space shuttle. There's a author named Jack Mano, whose book is Arming the Heavens, goes into the whole like fantasy life.
Well, the shuttle was designed to carry the Keyhole spy satellite, and which, by the way, is the what the Hubble Space Telescope was designed of. It was designed on the structure of the.
Well, you don't need to have the personnel aboard with the satellite. It doesn't make any sense to me unless you're
the shuttle
deployment. And Jack Mino also has a monograph called the military history of the space shuttle, and it was published in a journal called.
The military gave it its design specifications, but it was never used by the military. They after a while they saw how expensive it was and went off and used their Titan. Yeah.
But it affected the design in the ways that these.
It affected it in such a way that it made it bigger than NASA's requirements was for it. But it turned out to be the perfect launch vehicle for the Hubble Space Telescope, which has opened our eyes to the entire universe. And I think actually the Hubble is the finest result of the space shuttle. If we never had done anything with the shuttle other than launch the Hubble and then go up and repair it. I helped train the crew to go up and repair it.
You didn't need the shuttle to launch the Hubble, though. So.
Well, it turned out that we needed the shuttle to go up and fix it. So very definitely that was the shuttle's finest moment.
Mm. All right.
Well, Mr. Hickam, you would say that the shuttle was a success overall. I think that when it was having its last flights, I think there are some people who were perhaps questioning that one way or another, whether in fact it really was a success.
Yeah, the shuttle was a brilliant failure. it taught us so much about space, but it was ludicrously expensive. It was also a dangerous vehicle from the get-go. And a lot of it had to do, and again, I wrote about that in this Kindle single, Paco, the cat who meowed in space. I wrote about why the shuttle was compromised in its design from the beginning and why we kept flying it anyway. But all of us who has any real knowledge of NASA and how it works and so on, knew a long time ago that the shuttle needed to be retired. The only problem was that the NASA bureaucratically and funding-wise and schedule-wise and every otherwise was not able to build a replacement, and is still not able to build a replacement. That's why we're depending on young fellows like Elon Musk and SpaceX and the magnificent job they're doing. Hmm.
Well, I think the point of the caller, I think some other people have made the same point, is that the design of the shuttle was compromised because the military wanted something that they could use as to deliver payloads into near-Earth orbit that would be part of their plan to place weapon, you know, defensive and or offensive weaponry in space, and that if it had purely been designed as a craft that would do research work and didn't have any sort of military application, it would have been different.
That was only part of the puzzle at the beginning. Department of Defense has a lot of money, and NASA has very, very little money. So it was very attractive to NASA to use DOD funds. And, of course, the Department of Defense is charged to defend this country. The plan was never for the shuttle to carry any kind of weapons because it must be dangerous to take a human spacecraft and carry weapons into space. But it was certainly designed to carry spy satellites into space. And made a little bit bigger, and as a result, its design was was probably compromised from the beginning on that. If it had been a smaller vehicle that didn't have that great big cargo bay in the back, and we put it on top of the whole shuttle stack rather than on its side, we would have never had Challenger, and we'd never had Columbia, because in both cases, those happened because of the where the shuttle was in the stack, on the side, rather than on top and out of the way of any exploding solid rocket boosters or ice coming down to hit it. So that's what made the whole design of the stack compromise, was the necessity of the engineers having to slide the shuttle down on the side. It was a very, they made it work, but they had to work really hard every time they launched it to make the shuttle work.
Hmm. So you think that, again, we're talking here a little bit about a novel that is set more than 100 years in the future, where people are living and working on the moon. So that's a pretty long time horizon there. Do you think that within that, let's say within a century, do you really think that there will be significant numbers of people living long-term on the moon?
Yes, I do. The moon is essentially our eighth continent. It is part of the Earth. It got calved off the Earth several billion years ago by a Mars-sized planet that bounced off of us and took a piece of us off, and we created the moon. And the moon basically has been our protector ever since. If you look on the far side of the moon, it is just covered with a lot more craters than on the near side. And the reason for that is it's sort of acting like a shield for us. And also, from all of the debris left over from the creation of the solar system. Its tidal action has actually, we believe, is one of the reasons that life was successful here and ultimately moved from the sea and up on land. So we are, without the moon, I doubt that there would have been mammals, and without mammals, I doubt if there would have been us. So in a lot of ways, the moon is our spiritual mother, and it's one that I think we should focus our sights on. I believe it's up there for a reason. I think it's up there for us to live on, and ultimately, I think that we will go up there and make it our home.
Hmm. This book, this novel, Crater, is the first of a trilogy, and I am expecting that in your mind, you have not written the other two books yet, but you have them all plotted out.
Well, yes and no. I've almost finished book number two, which is due to the publisher in about 2 weeks. But I have in mind where it's all going. A lot of people bring me plots, and plots are nice, and I guess you need a plot for a book, but what I believe that people are interested in is other people. So it's the characters, Crater and Maria, his almost but hardly ever girlfriend, and the creatures that Crater encounters, especially the people who have been genetically modified to be either warriors or workers or even slaves. To me, this is more interesting than just the plot. So what I really have in my head are all of these characters and how to make them interesting, or they're interesting in themselves, and then putting them in interesting situations and let's see what happens.
Hmm. That's this touches on something, and maybe I read too much science fiction, but I guess one of the kinds of questions that interests me when I think about it is this question of human evolution and whether it's still happening, and whether in fact technology becomes at some point already has been in a long time ago, whether technology becomes an agent of that continuing evolution.
Well, in the second Crater, I do explore that a little bit more, and that is writers have written about robots, and they predict that there will be robots that are human-like and will work for us and do all these things. And I think to myself, and I've noticed that actually robots, mechanical electronic robots, are extremely difficult to build. But what is easy, relatively easy to build, are humans that have lowered IQs, the Forrest Gump level, that can then be manipulated to essentially be robots, and some people would call them slaves. And I fear that may be in our future, and it will be a huge moral crisis for the human race when that starts to occur. I think it's only a matter of time before somebody creates an organic robot simply by lowering the IQ of a human and making them very docile. But they'll still have an opposable thumb, and they will still have a brain, and that will be the ultimate robot. And I fear that day when it occurs.
Mm. Well, you're already, I know you said that you're just about finished with the second book, and that's due with the publisher pretty soon, and then there'll be a third book. Do you have an idea of what the next project then after that's going to be?
Well, a lot of people wanted me to get back on the memoirs, and the Kindle single about Paco, my cat, who meowed in space, and some other things in my early years, it was kind of a precursor of that. So I may very well get back and write a few more memoirs about perhaps my experiences in Vietnam or the other early years that I had researching, diving on the great wrecks off of Cape Hatteras and so on and so forth. I have a lot of stuff that I would love to write about. I look forward to it. A lot of it has to do with the publishers when they come to me and say, Homer, this is kind of what we're interested in getting from you these days. So we'll just see how it goes.
Our guest in this hour, Homer Hickam. You can head down to the bookstore or to the library or wherever you get your books. You can read his memoir, Rocket Boys. You can read his new novel, Crater. It is published by Thomas Nelson. And Mr. Hickam, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Well, thank you, David. I loved your questions, and I hope you liked some of my answers, and I sure did love hearing from your callers.
All right. Terrific. Thank you.